35, six of which led to full-blown military regimes. The first successful coup took place only 2 years after independence. That gave way for General Aboud's six-year reign before he was overthrown by a popular uprising known as the October Revolution. This was followed by only 4 years of an elected government before another general, Jafar al-Nimeiri, enacted his own coup in 1969. And each new wave of military rule became more and more brutal than the last. I mean, Nimeiri was a brutal dictator who further ripped at the seams of Sudan. Under his 16-year rule, even looking at the transition from Aboud's, you know, 6 years to Nimeiri's 16. Within that 16 years, just to give you a very simple but clear example, the inclusive independence flag of Sudan, which is blue, yellow, and green, representing the Nile, the desert, and the agricultural lands of Sudan, that was replaced with the flag you know today, red, white, and black, with the green triangle, representing a dominating Arab identity and Sudan's political shift away from Africa and towards the Middle East, right? And that shift and that claiming of an Arab identity obviously excluded a large part of this incredibly diverse African Sudanese population. Of course, this exclusion and marginalization was already happening, right, through colonial times, but also it's the reason why a civil war was raging in the South, which is now South Sudan. Since 1962, that war was raging, led by the Anyanya movement. And though Nimeiri was able to bring an end to that war by signing what is called the Addis Ababa Agreement in 1972, which essentially gave the South the right to self-rule, by 1983, he would completely undo that progress by enacting the September laws, which basically meant that Sudan now is applying Islamic Sharia law and declaring Sudan an Islamic state, right? This goes against, like I said, a very diverse, culturally diverse and also religiously diverse nation. And this move was met with much opposition, and along with the continued marginalization of the South and the persistent meddling of Nimeiri's government in the affairs of the self-ruled autonomous South, led to the dissolution of the Addis Ababa Agreement and the autonomy of the South as a whole, and triggered the Second Civil War, which was fought between the Sudanese armed forces, the Sudanese government, and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the resistance movement of the South. By 1985, Nimeiri was overthrown by, you guessed it, a popular uprising known as the April Revolution. That gave way eventually to a democratically elected government that took over a year later in 1986. Do you want to take a guess how long that lasted? Not very long, 3 years, only 3 years of democracy before another, say it with me now, military coup was carried out in 1989, this time led by then Brigadier Omar al-Bashir, in what he and his team, for lack of a better term, called the National Salvation Movement. Salvation was very, very far from what they brought. In fact, the Bashir government, which is puppeteered really by infamous Islamist and sociopath al-Turabi, was arguably the nail in Sudan's coffin. We went from 6 years under Aboud to 16 years under Bashir, under Nimeiri, and now 30 years under al-Bashir. In his 30-year rule, the Bashir government managed to dismantle what was left of Sudan's already rickety foundation. They continued in Nimeiri's footsteps, right-wing political Islamism, Arabization, violent repression of any and all dissenting voices, as well as the dismantling of trade unions. Any sort of popular organization was stifled, if not completely destroyed. And of course, not to mention the extreme corruption and gross misuse of Sudan's natural resources, either for political or personal gain, and of course, at the expense of the national interests and minimum basic services for the public. The ethnic and tribal divide that we've talked about before, which is an imbalance, like I said, that can be traced all the way back to colonial times, only grew under al-Bashir. The war in the south was inherited by this regime and still raging, and the continued neglect of the western region of Darfur and the effects of the Arabization campaign, which essentially carried out this gerrymandering that split the region into three separate states and favored ethnically Arab populations of Darfur at the expense of the African tribes there that became minorities, right? This gerrymandering sort of split things up to make these African tribes minorities in each of the three states. All of that led to eventually the resistance movement growing in Darfur. That was represented by the Darfur Liberation Front, the Sudan Liberation Army, and the Justice and Equality Movement. By 2003, Sudan was fighting a war on two fronts, both the southern and western fronts. And here, the Bashir government fell back on Nimeiri and others' past tactics of brute and excessive force, including the arming of the Arab tribes of Darfur. This happened first in the 80s to fight against the resistance movement in the south, and now they were being sort of armed and repurposed again to fight the armed resistance movement in the west. And this is the origin story of the Janjaweed, what you now know as the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF. The wars in South Sudan and in Western Sudan had a devastating impact, of course, most of all on the people themselves. At least 2 million killed in the South, more than 300,000 in Darfur, and millions displaced from both regions, both in and outside of Sudan. In 2005, a peace agreement was signed between the Sudanese government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the armed resistance movement of the South. But by then, the damage had already been done. And by 2011, South Sudan would gain its independence, becoming the world's newest country. Of course, the conflict in Darfur would continue to rage until 2020. In terms of foreign policy, whereas Nimeiri took on like this zigzagging campaign of shifting allegiances from east to west depending on interests, the Bashir government, their policy was powered purely by an Islamist ideology, right? They supported and harbored Islamist opposition leaders from various countries, giving them safe haven in Sudan. Many of these leaders were folks that were under the West terror lists, and all of these harboring and allegiances by the Bashir government led to the U.S. imposing sanctions on Sudan in the late 90s. And essentially, those sanctions, again, were just another nail in the coffin of Sudan. They destroyed Sudan economically, but also they kept Sudan completely isolated from the rest of the world. So we're talking about 3 decades at least, right? Just if we just consider the Bashir regime, we're talking about 3 decades in which the Sudanese people were choked by a violently oppressive and corrupt regime that siphoned resources away from basic social services, further impoverishing the population and making life incredibly difficult for it, and also facilitating the exploitation of Sudan's natural resources, and anything from oil to gold and uranium to Sudan's rich agricultural lands. These were exploited by the Bashir regime, like I said, for their personal and political gains by striking shady deals with countries in the Gulf, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Qatar, but also farther east, Russia and China were also big players in these shady deals and had a hand in exploiting Sudan's natural resources, and to this day, to be honest. During these three decades, life had become incredibly unbearable in Sudan, and the situation became gradually more untenable for the vast majority of the population. And so what happens when that is this case? Popular uprisings. They brewed, gradually intensifying despite the fact that they were violently and quickly and brutally repressed by a very heavily funded security sector. But by December 2018, there was no holding the people back. It had become, you know, the anger had boiled over. And the revolution began that led to the collapse of the Bashir regime in April of 2019. What came next was a transitional arrangement based on a partnership between civilian political forces and the military and security establishment, represented by military leader Al-Burhan and Rapid Support Forces RSF leader Hemeti. This, of course, is the same military and security establishment that were pillars of the Bashir regime and the same forces that were gunning down peaceful protesters in the streets during this revolution. I want to take a little break here and talk about these two military leaders. I think it's important to look into, you know, who these personas are. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who in the aftermath of the collapse of the Bashir regime in April of 2019, was presented as this neutral career military man who didn't have any political allegiances to anybody. He was here to represent the interests of the people through the military and bring a peace back to the situation. But you cannot be a high-ranking official in the Sudanese military under Bashir if you do not pledge your allegiance to the regime and to the Islamist movement. This is a position that, you know, all senior officers in the military had pledged or subscribed to the Islamist ideology. That was the only way to get ahead, not just in the military, but across the governmental sector. And not to mention that Al-Burhan has a very well-known, violent, infamous legacy in Darfur. The people of Darfur know of Al-Burhan by name, and during the revolution were mentioning this. When he was being presented as this neutral leader, the people of Darfur were saying, oh no, we know him, and we know the crimes that they committed upon us in the war in Darfur. On the other hand, you have Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, more popularly known as Hemeti, who in 2003 was the leader of the Janjaweed, who I mentioned before, these Arab militia that were armed by the Sudanese government to fight the resistance movement in Darfur. And he was later, well, he and his forces were later rewarded by the Bashir regime for these atrocities that they committed in Darfur by legitimizing them, turning them into what we now know as the Rapid Support Forces. They are a paramilitary group that works in tandem with the military. They were doing border security at one point. And through that period from 2013, when they were legitimized until now, all of this had allowed Hemeti and his forces not only to grow exponentially, I mean, they grew their forces in terms of manpower, but also in terms of political and economic power and influence. Incredible political and economic power and influence. So these are the two who are representing a new military and new Sudan, right? And who are supposedly pro-revolution. The plan in the post-revolution period, in this compromise that I talked about, is that the civilian political forces and this military component would rule jointly for 3 years and sort of pave the way for free and democratic elections and complete civilian rule, right? The military had said that, oh yeah, we don't want to rule, we just want to make sure that we can get Sudan to this democratic place that it needs to be at. But from the very beginning, and with all of that information in mind, I'm sure you can imagine that, you know, these the military and the RSF worked very hard to undermine this process. They blocked any attempts at reforms, and they paved the way to take over for themselves. And they did. By 2021, the two had enacted another coup, the latest in Sudan's 35 coup history. They dissolved the civilian cabinet and took full control of the country. Ironically, they claimed that their coup was for security reasons, that they were afraid that Sudan was going to slide into civil war, and this was the only way to keep the peace and keep people safe. But really, it was just a way for them to ensure that the military establishment would escape accountability for the numerous crimes that it had committed over the last 30 years, and that they would be, you know, in power. But, and beyond that, both Burhan and Himeti, both, they had their own aspirations to rule and to rule alone. So this partnership that they had very quickly turned from partnership to rivalry, and by April of 2023, full-blown enmity and war. I hope I covered everything. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for such, like, in 20 minutes, you managed to cover pretty much all of Sudan's 68-year history, and sort of giving us all a brief overview of how Sudan's history is inherently complicated because of the legacies of colonialism, and then sort of the way that things have progressed since, where the Sudani people were never really given a chance to rule themselves, and it was always the military intervening in rule until this day, and sort of the war that, or the situation that we're in right now with the war. And with that, we can transition now to Khulud, our second speaker, who's actually going to tell us about the initiation and progression of the conflict, which is really the point that Sada brought us up to.
Hi, Reem, can you see me?
Yes, we can see you.
Hi, thanks. And hi, everyone. I'm going to hopefully be as succinct as Sarah, although no promises, and really sort of walk us through how things got to, you know, where we are now, based on exactly where Sarah left off, which is, you know, how we got to that point where Burhan and Hemeti and their junior partners on either side got to the point where they could no longer reconcile their perspectives, their ambitions, etc. Because one thing we always have to remember is that despite everything we're hearing now in the social media space, all the statements that are made, you know, these guys were on the same page. And frankly, you know, I think in a nutshell, their mutual interests were suddenly superseded by their diverging interests. But those diverging interests had always been there. You know, we have to remember in about 2012 or so, Hemeti, then not formally part of the Sudanese army, had threatened Bashir, actually, after he helped wage war, frankly, against many groups in Darfur. He threatened Bashir and said, if you don't give me what I want, if you don't give me access to gold mines like I want, if you don't give me, you know, control over my own troops, then I'm going to effectively wage a war against you. And because Bashir was very aware that the war in Darfur had cost him a lot politically, he was already facing an indictment from the ICC, and he didn't need another headache in the West. He effectively ceded a lot of power and control to Hemeti, and really laid the groundwork for the entity and the personality, the entity of the RSF and the personality of Hemeti that we know today. So he has done this before. This is not the first time he has sort of gone against the formal army, the ruling institution. But what was different this time, of course, is that he was in a much better position to actually, you know, make good on that threat in 2023 than he was in 2011, 2012. But I think, you know, in many ways, SAF vastly underestimated what they had created. They created a monster, and that monster is now sort of biting them in the neck. And the rest of the country is effectively collateral damage to this tussle between different sectors of the Sudanese security apparatus. So that's a useful sort of punctuation, that 2011-2012 upset between Hemeti and Bashir, because it helps us sort of frame the goings-on later on, I think, in a much more historically relevant light. And so when we look at what happened, for example, in 2019, when Hemeti effectively went against Bashir and said, actually, I take my chances, sort of on my own without the patronage of Bashir. That wasn't the first time that he was willing to do that. But as I say, he was in a much better position. By that point, he was probably the richest man in the country and certainly had a lot of violence that he could mete out. And he had been formalized, not just earlier on in 2012, but in a law in 2017, enshrining the RSF as part of the security state effectively in Sudan. And so when he sort of, you know, turned on Bashir, and there are many accounts that say, you know, Hemeti was the one who personally arrested Bashir in April of 2019, you know, that sort of makes sense, given that we know that he has had this history with him before. And at that point, he was relatively happy to sort of remain within SAF because he was aware that he didn't have the right kind of, you know, he was able to sort of push against maybe the patronage of Bashir, but the political opportunity allowed for that, even with the revolution. He still, however, could not branch out entirely on his own. And it was only later on in 2023 when he was able to do that. So why was he able to do that? Well, the transitional period. And for those of us who lived the transitional period in Sudan, we can attest to this. You know, the military played such a big role in that transitional period. The civilian cabinet could hardly do anything really without having to either fight the military for it, or at least to in some degree get their blessing for it. And it's not as if, you know, as agreed in the constitutional document of 2019, the civilians were sort of able to administer the country, while the Sovereign Council, you know, sort of dealt with national and particularly international issues. That never really happened as envisaged. And I wanted to sort of really highlight that, because any kind of military-civilian agreement that we may see in the near future would probably follow that same trajectory. And we have to learn from that very, very recent history. But going back to 2019 and the transitional period, we saw, you know, a Hemeti who was trying to sort of ingratiate himself into the center. You know, before that, he was still very much the man in Darfur, the NCP's man in Darfur. But the transitional period really allowed him to make roots in Khartoum. And suddenly his ambitions of taking over the state from the center, not from the periphery, became much more of a reality. And he used his position to gain access to international allies and international partners that he never would have done were he still in ensconced in Darfur. He was allowed to sort of really get a sense of how the central very centralized state in Sudan worked, but also how central government worked. I wouldn't say that he's by any means an expert on this, and his lack of a governance plan to this day shows that he is, you know, it hasn't really reckoned with this. But the point is that he was exposed to it during the transitional period. And really, the fact that he still maintained his monies, and that was very different as an income source from SAF and from the rest of the security state in Sudan, the fact that he was able to cultivate different foreign policies from from SAF effectively, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, etc., also allowed him to position himself to wage this war. And the fact that he resisted integration at all costs, because integrating his troops into SAF would have lost him his biggest leverage. And that leverage is the fact that he's able to inflict a whole lot of violence and a whole lot of damage, which we're seeing him, not exclusively, of course, because SAF is doing it too, but we're seeing how he, as a sort of, you know, paramilitary group, is able to inflict that level of damage, which really internationally we've only really seen militaries, you know, fully fledged militaries do. And so, you know, oftentimes what we hear, particularly in the diplomatic space, is, you know, the inability of the RSF and SAF to, or SAF, the RSF to integrate into SAF is what, you know, sort of caused the war. And I would argue that that's not the cause of the war. That's a very ahistorical way, and frankly, just untrue way of looking at the trajectory of how we got here. The failure to integrate was a trigger for the war. And that trigger was, you know, it was sort of a slow burn, if you will. Think of a piece of dynamite with a very long lead. And that lead really started in December of 2022, so only 4 or 5 months before the war started. And that came with the framework agreement. The framework agreement was just lauded as this, you know, sort of the answer to post-coup Sudan. If anyone remembers the signing on the 5th of December, it was attended by so many international observers and diplomats, and they were all saying, you know, this is the thing that's going to get Sudan out of its rut. But in actual fact, it really fanned the flames of competition and enmity between SAF and the RSF. And that's because very integral to it was only two lines or so within the actual agreement. But this was the crux of the matter, which is that it allowed the RSF, and in particular Hemeti, to be elevated to Burhan's equal under this agreement rather than his deputy. So no longer would Hemeti answer to Burhan as the head of the armed forces, but both Burhan and Hemeti would answer to a civilian head of state as per the framework agreement, which for Hemeti would be great because it meant that he would be even more able to expand his influence over the Sudanese state and the region. But of course, for Burhan and his backers, most of whom are Islamists from the Bashir era, for them, this was a step too far. And what we saw from December of 2022 until April 15th, 2023, was, you know, an emboldening of the Islamists. Before, they were very quiet. They never dared really to come out to say anything during the transitional period because they were biding their time. They felt weakened. They felt that popular opinion was against them. But by seeing how unpopular the framework agreement was, this allowed them to feel so much more emboldened to put their, views out there. We saw some of them, even Mohammed al-Hassan al-Jazuli, who was a convicted terrorist under Bashir, he was able to come out and create a whole front just a few weeks prior to the war. We saw Islamists that we hadn't really heard of during the transitional period, including, of course, one of the key architects of this current political moment, Ali Kerti, really come out and have interviews and sort of really be publicly out there in a way that wasn't the case. And that's because they felt, the Islamists felt that they could, you know, that this was sort of the end game was approaching for them, and that they needed to, you know, sort of try and re-engage with their constituency. And of course, during the transitional period, you know, these Islamists, some of them had lost some of their assets, some of them had lost their freedom, some of them were in jail, etc. But we also saw they still maintained their political and economic relationships to the extent where they were able to continue to work, frankly, and to undermine not just a transitional period, but the period after the coup as well. What I would say is, going back to what caused this war, because we still don't have a sort of a forensic detailing of how we got here. Who fired the first shot? Was it the RSF? Was it elements related to SAF? What I would say is that security sector reform or integration of the RSF into SAF was the trigger, as I say. And the framework agreement created the conditions for those triggers to ignite a war. But the fundamental reason why the RSF and SAF were put on this path to conflict is because once they had led the coup of 2021 together, they started to have very different ideas about how they wanted to consolidate this coup. For Burhan, it was very easy. It was quickie elections, return some of the Islamists to power. And in fact, we did see right after the coup that particularly in the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and within the Ministry of Finance, we saw some key Islamist figures come back into power. And so he used that opportunity. But ideally, he wanted what we could call the El-Sisi model, a quick elections to sort of, you know, sanctify the coup and give it some level of legitimacy. And then he would be, you know, just like El-Sisi, the new sort of leader, sanctified by elections, internationally recognized elections, and then he would continue to rule and the revolution would be over and done with. For Himeti, you know,